Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Daniel Liebenson, the director of JU Chicago, an organization that, in its own words, seeks to inspire and empower every Jewish student at the University of Chicago. Daniel is also the president and founder of the Institute for the Next Jewish Future, which we will find out more about today. He previously served for 6 years as executive director of the University of Chicago Hillel and for 3 years as director of new initiatives at Harvard Hillel. Dan is the 2009 AVI Chai Fellow and has also received the Richard M. Joel Exemplar of Excellence Award, Hillel's International's highest professional honor. In 2010, he was named Jewish Chicagoan of the Year by Chicago Jewish News. Dan attended Harvard College and Harvard Law School, where he graduated magna cum laude, was an articles editor for the Harvard Law Review, and assisted Professor Alan Dershowitz in criminal defense work and on book projects, including The Vanishing American Jew. Before devoting his life to working in the Jewish community, Dan spent 5 years as a law professor after clerking on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. You will be able to find links to the various organizations Dan has been associated with, as well as an Eli Talk, which is the Jewish version of a TED Talk, over at our website. So please stop by and visit. Dan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's really great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, this is a special treat because it is coming on the heels of last week's discussion with Carmel Chiswick about the economics of Judaism. And we finished off that interview with some of the demographic challenges facing the Jewish community in America, which we noted is a small minority community. Now, Professor Chiswick largely looked at this issue through the lens of an academic, but also provided personal insights as a kid growing up in a Jewish neighborhood and also as a Jewish parent. You come at this at an angle as somebody who, what I would call a practitioner. It's not a practitioner just of your religious faith, which is important, but someone who has also created and run organizations that are meant to address a lot of the challenges facing members of the Jewish community. Nonetheless, though, you still come at this with the understanding of an academic, and I found you at a recent conference, the Association for Religion, Economics, and Culture out there in Boston, where you were presenting a paper and then also attended Carmel Chiswick's panel. So everything is just kind of coming together here. Everything is really complementary for one another. So I want to thank you for being able to do this on such short notice.
Sure, it seems like maybe even a higher power may be involved.
I am a firm believer in Providence, so yes, absolutely. But before we get into what you're doing in your work as a practitioner with JU Chicago and the Next Institute and all that kind of stuff, there's something that jumped out at me in your biography, and that was that you were the 2010 Jewish Chicagoan of the Year. Now, how does one get that? Is there somebody walking around the streets finding the most Jewish person in Chicago, or what? How do you get that?
It was a hard-fought battle. No, actually, it's not unrelated to some of what we're going to talk about today, because that's actually an honor bestowed by the local Chicago Jewish newspaper. And it's just sort of might sound like a funny concept that there is a Chicago Jewish newspaper, but actually, in a lot of large cities, there's a Jewish newspaper. And I think the idea is that when Jews were this sort of separate, small minority community, it was kind of like the local newspaper for the Jews. And as the Jews in America start to become more and more like everybody else, it starts to become anomalous that there's a Jewish newspaper, and it starts to, I think their readership starts to decline. But in any event, in some of the larger cities, these institutions still persist, and the idea is that they're trying to get their readers interested in what's happening in the Jewish world that they may not be familiar with. So I think they pick a few people from different dimensions of the Jewish community to tell their readership about, and I guess I was in the innovation category.
Oh, very cool. Was Mayor Emanuel upset that you got it instead of him?
Well, I think it was before he was elected.
So, oh, okay.
Before he came back to Chicago. So I think he probably wasn't upset about that. I wouldn't want to tangle with him now.
Okay. And did he invite you up to the mayor's mansion or something and give you the keys to the city or perhaps a Jay Cutler autographed football?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm still hoping.
If he gives you a Jay Cutler autographed football, then you just give it back because that's not a good sign. but seriously, though, that's kind of a neat honor being mentioned by the local Jewish press for doing outstanding work. But you also received something known as the AVI Chai Fellowship in 2009, which fashions itself as a Jewish version of the MacArthur Award. Explain what that is, and I assume that's coming with a little bag of funding that comes along with all those kind of fellowships. What you doing with that?
Right. Well, that was about 5 years ago, so I've already spent it all. The Avichai Foundation is a large Jewish foundation, which is actually spending down the foundation. It's sort of a new idea in the foundation world that instead of just spending a percentage of their endowment, they'll actually spend the entire endowment down over a limited period of time. And the idea is to try to make their mark in a limited period of time. So one of their legacy projects was to kind of select people that were doing work in the Jewish world that was at an earlier stage that in some way was in line with their values as a foundation and that would continue their work after the foundation had, in effect, died. So they chose 10 of us over a couple of years. And the instructions as to how to use the money was to essentially try to create something that you were only dreaming of. So what I did was actually start to put the pieces into place to create what's currently called the Institute for the Next Jewish Future, which I think we'll talk about later. But it's really an idea of trying to take what I was trying to do myself at the Hillel at the University of Chicago and try to build a larger organization around that would facilitate more innovation in the Jewish world.
That is very cool. And I also noticed that you pronounced it Avichai, and I pronounced it completely different. I'm looking at it in all caps,
right.
And I thought it was an acronym.
Right.
And so I'm going to mispronounce a lot of words today, and so you can just smack me upside the head and get my pronunciations right, because some of these words are unfamiliar to me, and I'm learning a lot from both Carmel Chiswick and a lot of other folks, and I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot from you as well. So let the learning begin here, and we'll get down to brass tacks. And one of the goals I have for our conversation today is to discuss what you are doing with the Institute for the Next Jewish Future, as well as some of the other things that you've worked with, JU Chicago, Hillel, and that. All of these entities, I believe, are designed to think about and foster Jewish identity, which can be very important for a minority community, as you mentioned, that's starting to get absorbed in the bigger culture around it. What I want to do is I want to start with what you consider to be some of the various challenges facing contemporary Judaism, and this is going to reflect upon our last week discussion with Carmel Chiswick. So give us your thought on these challenges.
I think in some way some of the larger challenges and also potential opportunities were revealed about a year or two ago by a study put out by the Pew Center, and it was a large study that they did of the Jews in America. And some of the major findings there were that a large number of Jews, and growing as the age of the Jews is younger, doesn't really understand Judaism to be a religion in their lives. So the Pew Center called them Jews of no religion. And the idea was that if you ask these people what religion they are, they'll say none. But then if you ask them later, are you Jewish, they say yes. And so the question is, what's going on there? What does that mean? Is that a crisis? And then those same people nevertheless express very high levels of pride in being Jewish, and even when you ask them, is being Jewish important in your life, they'll say yes. So that seems to be a substantial change in essentially who our market is, from people who might have said 50 years ago that Judaism is my religion, I may not practice so vigorously, but But basically, it's my religion, and I, you know, this is a synagogue that I don't go to that often, but I'm a member, etc. And so you can look at that development as purely a crisis, because if all these Jews are saying that Judaism isn't their religion, then isn't Judaism going to go away? But at the same time, you see these intensely high levels of pride in being Jewish, and so that makes you wonder whether there could be some new way of being Jewish that would emerge that would attract those people, and maybe other people as well. So in a way, what I'm working on is in all sorts of different ways and in all sorts of different age demographics, is what would the process look like of experimenting with new ways of being Jewish that might end up attracting those people.
Now, you just mentioned demographics that you're looking at as well. And last week, we talked with Carmel Chiswick about the cylinder of the Jewish population as compared to a pyramid. And she, in her own research, identified some new demographic categories that are in the Jewish population, but are also reflective within the general population as large. And two of these big areas which present challenges to Judaism and getting people into the synagogue are the young adult singles. So these are kind of just graduated from college, but you still haven't been married or had kids yet. So this is creeping up to, you know, age 22 to maybe about 30. And then there's a group of empty nesters, and these are the parents of those young adult singles who normally, maybe 50 years ago, would have been grandparents, but are not grandparents, so they don't feel like grandparents. And when you go to the synagogue, everybody says, why aren't you grandparents yet? Or talk to the young adult singles, why aren't you married yet? And it doesn't seem like as inviting of a place. Do you see these demographic challenges as well?
Absolutely. In particular, working as I do with college students, you think back to my parents. I remember when I was going to college, my parents would encourage me to go to Hillel so that I would meet a girl to marry. And even at that time, when I was in college, it seemed like that was kind of a plausible notion. Now, our students aren't thinking about marriage at all. You know, that's something that's going to happen to them maybe. You know, if you think about if they expect to be married in their mid-30s, you know, and right now they're 20, I mean, essentially it's almost as long as they've been alive. So it's not a event that they're looking forward to anytime soon. And so the whole way in which so this idea of the long period between college and marriage and having kids is not only important for that period itself, but also for the period that comes before it, being in college, being a teenager, because people don't have in their mind that they're preparing for that next stage in life. So instead we have this next stage in life that is not only not welcoming in the synagogue, but that is entirely devoid of any Jewish rituals that are targeted to that period of life. So in a great many ways, it's kind of an empty period in which even if you were inclined to be involved with Jewish life, there isn't a whole lot for you to do. And I think the empty nesters is also, for all the reasons that you said, a very significant period. One of the most significant dimensions of it, I think, is that a lot of people get involved in Jewish community when they have kids, because somehow in their mind it's about preparing the kids to take their roles in the Jewish community. So they spend a lot of time coming to synagogue and whatnot for their children and for their children's education. And when their children leave the house, many of them start thinking, well, what am I getting out of this? And if the answer isn't clear to them, then they'll drift away as well. And we see a lot of that, I think, in ways that we hadn't seen in the past.
Yeah, you rent the Harley-Davidson motorcycles and take off for a road trip around the U.S.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now, I'm looking forward to that. But you mentioned that this young adult single era that people are going through more and more frequently nowadays, and also to some extent these empty nesters, are periods devoid of Jewish rituals. And this prompted something in my mind. Last week we talked to Carmel about what she termed the great tradition of Judaism, which is the essential core religious doctrine, Torah, Talmud, Mishnah, and then also small traditions where these small traditions are, you know, different cultural practices that can vary across time and place and depending on what migrant community is around in a certain area. You also address some of this issue in your Eli talk about how Judaism has changed over time. There's the core, but there's also change in there. So tell us a little bit about the permanence and or the malleability of Judaism, ritualistic-wise, theology-wise, etc.
Right. Well, I'm thinking of, when you ask that question, I'm thinking about Steve Jobs at his Stanford commencement speech said something like, you can't connect the dots looking forward, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. So I think that when we look back on Jewish history, you can sort of connect the dots as this great tradition, but I think that as Jews are going through it, it's not as clear to me that there are these elements of the Jewish tradition that necessarily are sort of inviolable or have this notion that they can't be played with. And I think that a lot of the most significant changes in Jewish history involved a rejection of what Carmel Chiswick calls the great tradition in one way or another. I think one of the more recent versions of that was the emergence of secular Zionism as a major component of the Jewish community, in the sense that the secular Zionists, the founders of secular Zionists, essentially rejected the Torah and the Talmud and said that and religion, and understood themselves in the creation of the State of Israel to be creating a secular version of Judaism that didn't need religion. And we can debate about whether that's been successful or not, or to what extent that Israel is becoming more connected on the back end to the religion again. But I think that some of these, but in any event, whether or not Israel is becoming more religious and more tied into that great tradition again, certainly a major change has taken place in terms of how Jews define Judaism, putting the State of Israel in a serious position as far as how Jews define what it means to be Jewish, many Jews, not all, in a way that really didn't exist 100 years ago. So I think that that came about through a process of reimagination that really was extremely controversial and not accepted by the vast majority of the sort of Jewish establishment of its time. And so what I'm suggesting that we need to be doing is looking for more and encouraging more and more experimentation that takes place outside of the borders of what we sort of consider the acceptable great tradition of Judaism. Because I think that the people the reality of the people of the Jewish people today is profoundly different from what it was when some of those traditions were meaningful. So I think that in order to discover new ways of being Jewish that really are going to resonate with people, we actually have to start with where the people are and not so much with where the tradition is. And that process of innovation is described in the business literature, primarily by a professor at Harvard named Clayton Christensen, as disruptive innovation. And it's the idea that innovations, game-changing, sort of paradigm-shift innovations, tend to emerge not out of an existing product or an existing organization, but rather outside of the zone of the existing product and in the realm of the people that are currently non-consumers of that product. So I'm interested in going to the people that often get described as the nuns, the religious nuns, or all these Jews who are being found by this Pew study as saying that Judaism is not their religion. And I'm particularly interested in working with that population and saying, well, how could we find ways in which elements of Judaism might resonate with them? And if we can find those ways, then I think what we'll start to see is the building up of a new approach to being Jewish, which over time, like secular Zionism did, will probably start to pull elements from the older way of being Jewish, and maybe over time will not look as different as it does on the front end. But I think that way of Judaism evolving is actually has happened over and over again in our history, and only looking backwards does it appear as if there's this great tradition that sort of persisted throughout the ages.
You said something that piqued my attention, and it was something that we didn't get to talk about last week, and that's the issue of Israel here. And you used the term, the controversial reimagination of Israel. Explain a little bit more what you mean by that and how that is factoring into everything that you're talking about here, this process of disruptive innovation.
Well, what I meant to say was that in the mid to late 1800s, when secular Zionism was first emerging in the Jewish world, there really wasn't any serious thought given to having a Jewish state. There were sort of messianic aspirations that were part of the Jewish prayers, but there really wasn't a notion that without the help of God, we were going to go back and create a Jewish state. And so what the secular Zionists did was to move that messianic aspiration from the prayers in the synagogue to a political plan. And not only that, but they, in fact, rejected the prayers from the synagogue, and they said, you know, this new Jewish state that we're going to create isn't going to have anything to do with your synagogue prayers and your religion. This is going to be a next step in the history of Judaism, where we are going to transcend religion, or we're going to end the religion, and we're going to instead reestablish ourselves as a secular nation state. So I think it's hard to see from 100 years later what a huge shift that was, and how much of a rejection of the Judaism that was dominant in its day that was. But, you know, if we look at the Jewish world in the 1800s, there wasn't a lot of support for Zionism among most of the large establishment Jewish organizations, ranging from the Orthodox, who said that secular Zionism was a heresy because it was non-religious, and to the Reform, who also said that, you know, for a variety of reasons, largely I think their desire to facilitate sort of cultural assimilation into the various countries in which Jews lived, they also opposed Zionism because they didn't want there to be an appearance that Jews were anything but loyal citizens of the states in which they lived. So only slowly and over time did Israel emerge as an important dimension of what it means to be Jewish in the 20th century. Now, what I think we're seeing today among young people is, to some extent, a questioning of that. I think that, you know, young people in America in particular are understanding themselves to be essentially Americans of a Jewish persuasion or of a Jewish ethnicity, and they're far enough away from the Holocaust that they don't sort of have the trauma of anti-Semitism driving them. And they look at Israel and they say, well, you know, I don't feel the driving need to have a Jewish state because I don't feel afraid of anti-Semitism, and I feel very comfortable as an American, so I'm not really sure what this country is all about, and I'm not sure why it should be a major dimension of my own Jewish identity. So I think that's a really interesting and important issue that the Jewish community has to contend with, but one thing that I want to make clear is that the sense of connection to a modern Jewish state is really something that was only possible for Jews for the last 100 years, right? It's not a part of being Jewish that has been part of being Jewish for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. And so that's neither to say that it's important or that it's unimportant, but that it's important for us to understand that these aspects of what we think are central to being Jewish are often not quite as ancient as we think they are.
Some interesting thoughts there, and you're talking about how young people are re-envisioning this, and you also mentioned that a number of them are becoming nuns or secular Jews, and that one of your goals has been to go to the people who are these folks, the secular Jews, and work with them. And I want to talk about a number of these different issues. Now, one of those that you have been involved with in the past is Hillel. And I know about this being in the university environment. I know there was one at UCLA. I know that there was one currently here at the University of Washington. What is this organization? I see posters for it all the time, but I'm not really sure what it is.
Right. So Hillel, it's interesting because it's also important to understand Hillel's history. So when Hillel was founded, which I believe was in the 1940s, when Hillel first started popping up on campuses, that was a time in which there was a significant amount of anti-Semitism in America. There was certainly tremendous anti-Semitism elsewhere in the world, and there was a tremendous sense of trauma among Jews about the anti-Semitism in Europe that had caused the Holocaust. And there was a sense that Jews were socially not welcome into many elements of American society, and yet at the same time, a lot of Jews were starting to go to college because they were, you know, a generation or two beyond the immigration of their families, and they were sort of able to go to college. And so you had a lot of Jews in college, but they didn't feel like they were part of the university. So they created these Hillels, and they were basically meant to be a place where Jews could feel comfortable at least once a week, at least during the day. Sometimes if they felt otherwise uncomfortable in college, they could be together as Jews every once in a while and sort of gain some strength through that. Over time, as Jews became more and more integrated into the American society in general and in the universities in particular, and in fact became extremely successful in the world of American universities, both as students and as faculty, that need for sort of a Jewish place of refuge on the campus wasn't as great anymore, and Hillel sort of evolved into an umbrella organization for where Jews could engage in all sorts of Jewish activities, ranging from prayer services to cultural activities. Now I think that as Jews have become even more integrated into the university community, I think that there's a divergence between the needs of Jews. Some Jews, a minority of Jews, feel intensely that being Jewish is an intensely important part of their life. It's something that they do all the time. They might be Orthodox or otherwise observant, and they have to go to services every week. They might eat only kosher food or whatever, and so they need an organization. They need a place that's going to be able to facilitate those various Jewish needs, and Hillel serves that role. There's another group of Jews in college who have occasional Jewish needs, right? They like to celebrate the holidays. Every once in a while, they like to have a Friday night dinner. They'd love to go to some cultural activities sometimes. And essentially, their needs, you know, that they would be well served by an organization that provided for those more limited needs periodically. And then there's a third group of Jewish students who don't have any conscious need for Jewish activities, right? They're not all that interested in participating in Jewish activities. But if there could be Jewish activities presented that were compelling, they aren't necessarily against it, and they might like to participate in those activities. Hillel is trying to fulfill all three of those needs. And that Hillel kind of defines its mission today as being the center for Jewish life on campus and being, again, an umbrella organization that's going to try to provide for all three of those categories of Jewish students.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your parents told you to go to Hillel to find a girl to get married to, so it's not the Jewish version of eHarmony, is it?
not directly, but it was sort of the pre-eHarmony idea, right, that it's that you would go there and physically meet people. But I think that one of the challenges that the Jewish community faces in all sorts of ways is the challenge of the Internet and the digital age. And so now, if you were inclined to try to find a Jewish woman to marry, you might be better off using the Jewish version of eHarmony is actually called JDate. And you might be better off using JDate because you could cast a much wider net than whoever might happen to show up at your local Hillel that evening. And so the question then becomes, well, then what's the case to go to Hillel, what's the case to actually go to that physical place where other Jews go? And I think that all sorts of factors are raising questions about that.
And you must have been thinking about this for some time, because this is at the top of your agenda and you've innovated a number of other organizations related to these different types of challenges. But I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy, and I like to figure out how people do their job on a daily basis. And you were in Harvard Hillel for a couple years, organizing that group, and then directing the one at University of Chicago for about a half dozen years or so. What did you do on a daily basis?
Well, as the executive director on a daily basis, a lot of the way that I would spend my time is supervising staff that are doing various elements of this work, raising money. That's become a huge element of what it means to be the executive director of a Hillel, because they often have large buildings that are expensive to run, and large staff that are expensive to pay. So, fundraising is a big piece of it, as well as just the sort of day-to-day mechanics of running an organization, you know, getting the bills paid, et cetera. But on a more, sort of ideas level, the thing that I think all Hillels are really trying to do all the time is to figure out how can we serve these three different types of Jews effectively. You know, how can we provide activities for those different kinds of Jews that are quality activities, and how can we actually get those different kinds of Jews to come to those activities. So with the first group, let's call them the religious students, the ones who are looking for a place to pray and need to eat only kosher food, it's not very difficult to get them to come. They basically have to come. It's not really difficult to serve their needs in the sense that their needs are clearly well-defined. It is very expensive to serve their needs because they need a place to pray, and so they need real estate. They don't necessarily need, but they very much want to have a rabbi who is going to be there to answer their religious questions or to organize various things. For kosher food, they need a separate kitchen. So there's a lot of needs that are very expensive, and I think that Carmel Chiswick talks about this as part of her thinking about why Judaism has changed in America over time, is because a lot of Jews weren't willing to pay that price, whether it be an economic, a money price or a time price. The challenge for a Hillel then becomes, I have to spend all this money on a very small number of people who have these very distinct and defined religious needs, right? Can I figure out how to spend whatever money I have left to provide programming that's compelling and exciting enough to essentially attract the people who really, like Carmel Chiswick talks about, who are very conscious of their time budget, right, and are only going to spend their valuable time on Jewish activities that are extremely compelling to them. So am I going to be able to figure out how to provide opportunities like that to those two populations who are not necessarily all that focused on engaging in Jewish activity as a primary driver in their lives? And that trying to figure out that balance is a big part of the job, and I'm not totally sure how to describe this in sort of economic terms, but a major issue is that because the religious students are in the building all the time, because they have to be, right, because that's where they get their food and that's where they pray three times a day, the other students tend to understand the Hillel building to be a synagogue, right, to be a religious place, even though Hillel as a organization and the Hillel staff tries to send the message that this is not a synagogue and this is not a purely religious place. This is a place that is meant to serve all Jews. But nevertheless, because when you walk in the door, there are a lot of religious people around, other students tend to think of this as a religious place, and if they themselves don't see themselves as religious, which the Pew study tells us that most of them don't, no matter what's going on in there, you're facing a real obstacle in their feeling like this is my place and this is somewhere that I'm going to be able to connect.
Yeah, the very religious students basically change the nature of the product or service that you're actually providing. And I can see how some of the secular Jews or the nuns that you're trying to recruit look at this thing and saying, oh, all those religious-y people are going to be there and going to be laying some heavy stuff on me, and it's going to be just like Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses knocking on my door. They're going to try to recruit me and all this stuff. I don't know if I want to pay that price. I just want to hang out with people who kind of grew up in my same neighborhood.
Right, and it may not be that they are afraid that they're going to try to recruit me, but I think that there's a lot of sense, for a variety of reasons, there's a lot of sense, I think, among the Jews that are not religious that, you know, the kind of, in some fashion, the real way to be Jewish is to be religious. And so if I'm not religious, then I'm kind of not, quote, a good Jew. And, you know, I'm not sure that I want to be reminded of that all the time when I'm just hanging around, you know. Yeah. So I think it's less a sense of fear that that they're going to try to get me to be religious, and more a sense that I'm not going to feel that good about myself.
I want to take a sidestep here and ask a question that I'm curious about, because I've had a number of students, number of Jewish students at the University of Washington that keep poking me in the side and say, oh, you got to interview this guy from Chabad who's around campus quite a bit. And I haven't gotten this guy on the podcast yet, but it's something that's on the agenda. What is Chabad? Is that somehow related to Hillel? Is it the similar thing? Is it got the same kind of goals? Clarify that for me.
It's complicated. It's not really similar to Hillel. In fact, it's quite distinct from Hillel because, like I said earlier, Hillel fashions itself the center of Jewish life on campus. So Hillel really wants to be the place where you can come in and do anything that you want that's Jewish. And some years ago, I'm not sure exactly when, Chabad started to come onto campus and to say, well, we don't sort of buy that model, and we want to do our own thing, and we want to have our own space and our own organization and our own people, and we're trying to do something really different, and we don't think it can happen in the in this sort of big tent. What Chabad is, in some ways, I think you have to interview them and allow them to give their own perspective on it. They probably wouldn't agree with the way that I would characterize it, but essentially, Chabad is an ultra-Orthodox organization. There's a number of different kinds of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. This one is one called Hasidic Judaism, which tends to be more spiritual than other forms of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, which are more about study and Talmud study. But the truth is that the Hasidic and the non-Hasidic streams have kind of started to look more similar to one another than distinct. But Chabad is a particular one of these subgroups, and they, for a variety of sort of theological reasons driven by their previous great rabbi, have an idea that essentially the Messiah will be more likely to come the more commandments are fulfilled. And so it's important to them that Jews are fulfilling religious commandments, even if they are not living Jewish religious lifestyles overall. They have a sort of a theological principle that it's just good to have more and more commandments fulfilled. So they are driven by this desire to try to get Jews, not only on campus, Chabad exists all over the Jewish world, to participate in at least a little bit of Jewish ritual activity. And that's their main goal. On campus, they accomplish that through a variety of different kinds of programs, not all of which are necessarily focused on fulfilling religious commandments, although most of what they do tends to have a religious dimension, right? They don't tend to do too many, Super Bowl watching parties or, you know, even things that are more along the lines of artistic or creative expressions of Judaism. They have a particular form of Orthodox Judaism that they believe in, and they really try to get students to participate in that way of practicing Judaism, although I think it's really important to understand that they're not really trying to get people to become Orthodox. They're not missionaries in quite that way. They're trying, I'm sure they would be thrilled if people did become Orthodox, But what they're really trying to do is to get people to just fulfill one commandment at a time.
Got it. Okay, that helps clarify that. Here's another thing I need some clarification for. You were at Hillel Chicago for about 3 years, and or 6 years, and then you moved on and created something called JU Chicago. And I just kind of realized as I'm looking at this on my sheet of paper, JU could that be like a simplified version of Jew?
Yeah.
Okay, I get that now. It's a play on words kind of thing.
It is. It's funny because I always, when we founded it, I wanted it to be pronounced Jew Chicago. Mm. And in fact, over time, we hope to expand to other campuses, and I really wanted the name of the organization to be JU, Jew. Mm. What's interesting is that a lot of people think that the word Jew is a pejorative and don't like to say it. Now, Jew is not a pejorative. It's an interesting situation where Jew, you know, we are Jews. That's what we are. But I think that because in the past a Jew was used as a pejorative in one way or another, somehow the word has an unpleasant feel in people's mouths, and they don't want to pronounce it. So it sort of ended up being called JU Chicago. I hope one day that we will rescue the word Jew from feeling like a pejorative to people, and then it will be pronounced as Jew.
There's another interesting feature to this, too, and I invite people to come to our website or go directly to your website to see this organization, because it is really fascinating. The first letter is smaller caps.
Right.
And why is that?
Because we were sort of playing with the idea of the I in Apple's product, you know, the iPhone, and it was a J, and the idea was just kind of to position it in that world of both. I think there's two dimensions to it, right? One is that it is part of your actual life, right? Whether that's your digital life or it's part of the lives that we actually lead in the secular world. A lot of them using stuff that starts with the lowercase I. And also, I think that the idea of the I in iPhone and iPad is this idea of personalization, of this is really about how am I going to fit this to my needs. And what we're trying to suggest is that this Jewish material is something that you can take into your life and build around your own needs and your own beliefs, rather than having to come to something that somebody else has created and that doesn't really fit your needs.
Not being an Apple aficionado and not really understanding the lowercase I, that completely flew by me. But I'm not the target for this group or organization. And that brings me to my next question of what is this organization really about? Why did you move on from Hillel to create JU Chicago or Jew Chicago, which seems like it might be the same thing as Hillel. What's the difference, and why was it created?
Well, the way that it's different, I would say, is primarily there are two ways in which it's different. Number one is when I laid out the three types of Jews, right, the ones who have a driving religious needs, the ones who have some Jewish interest, and the ones who don't perceive themselves to have any Jewish interest, that Hillel primarily, not intentionally so, but Hillel basically has to serve that first group first, and then sort of whatever's left over can be deployed in some fashion for the others. JU essentially reverses the emphasis and says, you know, our first priority is to work with the Jewish students who don't have driving Jewish needs. And we also are happy to serve the Jews who do have driving Jewish needs, but we'll serve them in a context and in a way that's primarily built around the nuns, right? The attempt to find ways of living Jewishly that's going to work for the people who don't have driving religious needs. In many ways, I think that JU and Hillel are and should be complementary, right? I think that one of the main reasons why we can be JU is because there is a Hillel, right? If there wasn't a Hillel and there wasn't any way to have Jews with religious needs to have their needs met, it would be hard to justify there being a JU that wasn't serving those religious needs in a serious way. So I see the two as very complementary, but I think that my experience in Hillel was that it just wasn't really possible to serve the entire Jewish community through a single organization, and that it makes much more sense for there to be two separate organizations with different missions and with different emphases.
So what are some of the things that you do to engage this third group, the secular Jews, the nuns, as they might be called? You mentioned already Super Bowl parties, and I would be completely down with that. But are there other ongoing activities throughout the year or throughout the academic year that you focus on?
There are. I should say, I'm not even sure that we've had a Super Bowl party. So that was just an example that I ripped up. But
You're in Chicago, and you got Jay Cutler. So it's going to be a few more years. So
right. But, if we were in New England, it would be completely different.
There you go. Yeah.
Or Seattle, right?
That's right.
I said there were two primary ways in which we're different from Hillel. The other one is that we don't have a physical space. We rent some space to sit during the day for our staff, but we don't have a physical space where our programs take place. Instead, we facilitate students creating their own activities in their own spaces, whether that means their dorm rooms or their apartments or campus spaces. So, and that's basically the answer to your question, or part of the answer to your question. One of the things that we do is we find and connect with students that are not especially religious or not especially oriented to the kinds of large-scale activities that take place, like religious services, and yet have some interest in Judaism or exploring it. And we have an internship program where we hire those students essentially to work for us as staff, and we have a program where we study Jewish ideas with them and also study principles of community organizing, of innovation, of design thinking, and we work with them to come up with ideas of Jewish activities that they think that they would find compelling for themselves and that they think would be compelling for their friends, and then we provide funding for them to try those activities out. So those could range from things that are actually quite familiar, like Friday night dinners in their own apartments, but that are based on a ritual that they select as to what appeals to them, as opposed to some standard ritual that they have to use. And it can range from that all the way to completely completely new types of activities, like a group. There are things that are simple, like book clubs, but there was a group that said we want to really create something where we do social justice work with different communities, but we do it through a Jewish lens. And there was a group that wanted to do some kind of Jewish prayer-like ritual, but they really loved yoga, and so their idea was, could we try to find a way to fuse our yoga practice with Jewish ideas? And they ended up creating a Passover Seder that used body positions instead of symbolic foods to try to to reenact the movement from slavery to freedom, which is what the Passover Seder is supposed to be all about. So all kinds of creative expressions like that. And some of them work and some of them don't, and that's the whole idea, is that this is about experimentation and seeing what resonates, and once we start to see that something resonates, then we say, well, how can we figure out how to try to do more of that?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something called design thinking, and when you said that, I started thinking you're designing buildings. I thought architecture. What is design thinking?
Design thinking is the idea that the way in which designers, like architects and other kinds of designers, think is actually applicable to walks of life other than the ones in which we typically think about design occurring in. So the idea that a Jewish experience in your home, for that to be really resonant and powerful, that it needs to, you need to sort of put the same care and attention into it as you would if you were designing a new product. And so there are actually a lot of design schools these days have recognized that that the way of thinking that they've developed for, you know, product design is actually applicable to a wide variety of types of things, and they have started to offer classes and degrees and just online presentations on and books on what these principles are, and we're playing around with that and trying to apply it to Jewish life. One of the most important principles of design thinking really is that you have to start by understanding who it is that you're trying to have use your product. And you have to really understand those people at a deep level. You have to understand their needs, and you have to understand how they go about their lives in general, what might be missing from their lives, and also once they encounter the thing that you're trying to present them with, you know, how are they going to encounter it? Where are the places where they're likely to hit a roadblock? And if you can really understand where they're likely to hit a roadblock or what they're really looking for, then you can start to understand how I need to adjust what I'm doing in order to really connect with them.
Sounds like old-fashioned marketing research, which I used to do.
The difference between marketing research and design thinking is that with marketing research, you're primarily talking about how can I take an existing product that is going to remain more or less the same and try to get you to buy it, try to get you to connect with it. The design thinking says, I want to change the nature of the product in order to serve the needs that you have.
Yeah, this is probably why I was never good at marketing research. So I should have done a little bit more design thinking. But speaking of design thinking, and this is thinking about changing the ways we organize, the way we interact, and all those kind of things, you also founded and are the current president of something called the Institute for the Next Jewish Future. And this kind of has a science fiction ring to it, and it seems to be embedded in Jew Chicago because it's on your website and connected in there. Explain what this is and its relationship to JU or Jew Chicago.
Sure. Well, first of all, any of your listeners who can come up with a cooler name for us could win a prize. The Institute for the Next Jewish Future was partly the product of the fact that we had to file the papers with the IRS to get our tax-exempt status, and we needed a name. So we thought, you know, at one point we were thinking the Institute for the Jewish Future, and then one of our board members thought it would sound cooler if it was the Next Jewish Future. So, you know, since it was really just for the IRS papers, we said, oh, that would be cool, but eventually we'll find a different name. We haven't found a different name yet, so we're still working on it. But the idea is that to take what we've been talking about vis-a-vis college students and to understand that this represents a need for the Jewish community at large, at all age demographics, and to say, well, what could we create? And this is really what I wanted to do with that Avichai grant, to say the work that I'm doing on campus, I happen to be doing it with college students for some accidental reasons and some strategic reasons, but this is stuff that is actually applicable to Jews at any age. And so can I create that entity that's going to be the, it's going to basically do three primary things. One is to be kind of a think tank that's going to say, can we start to study these needs and articulate our strategies in increasingly precise ways that can actually be taken by other organizations and applied, or by people starting up new organizations and applied. Because we're actually articulating a very clear agenda for how we should move forward with Jewish innovation in the future. And number two is, can we essentially become a school for professional leaders and also lay leaders, where we're essentially developing human capital that thinks about Judaism in this new way? Because I think that most people think about Judaism, and not only Judaism, I think most existing religions and organizations, most people say, okay, well, if we need to do some innovation, if we really need if we're having a problem staying the way we are, what can we tweak at the margins, and how can we make some small changes, and maybe, like you said, some marketing, and maybe that'll solve our problem. And we're saying, no, what we think is we need something more dramatic. We need people to step far outside of the existing institutions and start building new institutions at or beyond the margins. So because people don't typically think that way, we need to articulate those ideas really clearly, and we need to develop human capital that does think that way. And so how can we start to generate a pipeline of Jewish leadership that thinks about innovation from the outside in, as I say? And the third is that once we start having those types of projects, how can we help them be successful? How can we help direct money to them? How can we network them with one another? How can we start to use their experience to feed back into our system and to better understand the needs? And so how can we, you said that I was a practitioner, which is true, but I sort of think of myself as a thinker-practitioner, right? The idea that I'm trying to do this stuff on the ground, and I'm also trying to constantly look at what I'm doing and abstract from it. How could we create a whole cadre of Jewish leaders that are like that and that are having conferences and that are writing together and that are essentially the faculty of this training center? So that's basically the aspiration for the Institute.
I have to say that I think practitioners are all thinker practitioners, because I have this little bias toward interviewing folks who basically are in the trenches trying to do this thing, because, you know, us academics think we think about stuff all the time, but the people who have skin in the game, who are making these changes all the time, have to be thinking and making decisions on, you know, does this work? Does this not work? So I think thinking and practitionering, which is not really a word, but though those things are very linked, which is very cool about what you are doing. I got one question before I move on to something else that you said and training leaders for the future, but this relates back to JU Chicago. How many students are involved in this, and how have they been receiving it?
It's interesting because on a college campus, you never really know necessarily what your denominator is, because there's not a clear way to know how many Jewish students there are. and it's a little hard to tell what your numerator is, because you aren't necessarily sure who's Jewish that's participating. That said, we think that there are about 800 or so, 850 Jewish students at the University of Chicago, undergraduates. And we documented the participation last year of, I believe, about 650 students.
Wow.
So it's a huge percentage.
Yeah, it's a good batting average.
Right, it's a good batting average. Now, the question is, well, how significant was that percentage? How significant does it have to be, right? I mean, what are we really trying to do? Are we trying to change people's lives in a profound way? And can we measure whether we have, or is it really just enough that people are participating in one or two events? And I think we're still actually trying to work on defining for ourselves what success looks like. But I feel like we certainly proved wrong any kind of notion that these Jewish students are allergic to participation in Jewish life, that they will not participate under any circumstances. I think it's clear that they will participate if the opportunity is right.
That is very cool. And so you're getting the young'uns all up and activated in all of this kind of stuff. But to return to what we were saying before I took us out for a step there, was training leaders for the future. And this is what the Institute for the Next Jewish Future is about, and what the paper that you presented at ASREC in Boston was about as well, is getting the rabbinate involved. And is it the rabbit? Am I pronouncing that rabbinate correct?
Yes.
Okay, because it's rabbit. It sounds like rabbit. What are you trying to do here, and what are some of the challenges that you're facing in involving the Jewish clergy in rethinking, reimagining what Judaism is going to be in the future?
It's the article that we presented at the ASREC conference was a chapter that I and a co-author, Barak Richman, who's a professor of law and business at Duke, and he's an economist, we co-wrote this book chapter in a book on the future of rabbinical education. And Barak and I are also working on a book on some of what we're talking about as a more general idea, this notion of disruptive innovation within Judaism. And in the world of innovation in general, most cases in which there's a game-changing paradigm shift innovation comes from outside of the dominant practitioners in in any particular field. The question is, can organizations that are in the center of whatever field we're talking about, are they simply unable to innovate in a way that could be part of the future, if the future is going to be a paradigm shift, or is there a way that they can? And most of the most of history suggests that they can't and they won't, but not all. And in the world of business, one of the great examples of the capacity of a large organization to be part of this innovation towards the future was the Dayton Hudson Corporation, which was a department store company. And they were all the department stores were being threatened by big box retailing like Walmart. And Dayton Hudson bought a small company at that time called Target, and they basically invested in them, but didn't interfere with them. They allowed them to compete on price with their department stores, et cetera, et cetera. And they found a way to kind of incubate Target in such a way that they didn't destroy it, which is rare. And eventually Target became so successful that it competed very well against Walmart and the other similar organizations, and became so successful that they eventually changed the name of the company to the Target Corporation, and then later even sold off the department store business to Macy's. So what we're wondering is, can we imagine, can something happen so that a story more similar to the Dayton Hudson story would happen to the existing institutions of Jewish life, whether that be the synagogues or a particular Jewish denomination, or the rabbinate as an institution, rather than going in the usual path of a Kodak or Polaroid or these dominant companies that end up going bankrupt, even though the field in which they exist, photography, is actually very healthy. So we're really looking at that question and wondering if rabbis are being trained essentially to take positions in synagogues, but synagogues are merging and closing, and does that just mean that there's going to be fewer jobs for rabbis, and eventually all the rabbinical schools are going to have to merge into one, and they'll just be only producing a very small number of rabbis every year? Is there some way that rabbis as an institution can reimagine their role and therefore be trained differently for another role? In our article, we suggest some analogies to the world of medicine, where we also see that whereas there used to be just kind of one type of doctor, now there's all sorts of specialization of doctors, and there's also all kinds of para medical roles like nurse practitioners and physician assistants and all kinds of other roles where they've been able to create a whole variety of types of medical practitioners that help people with a wide variety of medical needs. And so the question is, can the rabbinate develop a whole set of rabbis and quasi-rabbis that would help Jews with the whole range of Jewish needs? Truth be told, I'm not optimistic that they can, but our article was trying to explore how they might think about it.
Yeah, the Dayton Hudson story is very interesting. In the paper that you had, you emphasized the medical profession. And I thought that was really a very cool analogy. Rabbis are medical healers of the souls, I guess, but they have to understand that different people have different things, so we need different specialties. So it was a very cool paper. And if it's available for linking, we will try to link it up on our website. And when your book comes out, we'll make sure that link to it as well. One final question here as we close out our time is, you've been thinking a lot about these issues. You've been engaged in these organizations that are trying to re-engage a lot of people who have not been engaged, as well as working with the people who are fully engaged, very holistic approach to the issue of Judaism in America. What are your thoughts and how have they developed over time about where the future of Judaism is? You worked with Alan Dershowitz on a book called The Disappearing American Jew. Is that the course that you see in the future, or are you more optimistic about the changes that are to come?
In general, I'm an optimist, and I think that the wisdom contained within Judaism from a 3,500-year history is it's really significant wisdom. It's things that we need in order to live happy, successful, contributory lives. And there aren't a whole lot of other avenues through which to get this kind of ancient wisdom. So I think that there will be a efforts to try to figure out how to connect that wisdom with people in their lives, and eventually one of them, or more than one of them, will resonate and be successful and take off. One of my colleagues talks about when she was graduating from rabbinical school that the head of the rabbinical school came to talk to her class and said that he had just been on the phone with a famous Jewish sociologist who was interpreting a previous demographic study of the Jewish community. And he said, well, what does the study show? And the sociologist said, well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that Judaism will still exist in 100 years. And he said, well, so what's the bad news? He said, well, the bad news is it'll be entirely unrecognizable to us. And both my colleague and I don't think that's a bad thing. Right, we think that the Judaism of today would be entirely unrecognizable to the Jews, for example, during the Second Temple period, and that if there's a Judaism that is unrecognizable to us, in whether it's 100 years or 1,000 years, that would be okay as long as the stuff that's really important is preserved. And it's not clear who's to say what the stuff that's really important is. You know, I believe, I have a faith in people that they will preserve what's really important because they need it. And we may discover that things that we thought was really important is less important. So, for example, it would have been unimaginable, I think, to Jews during the Second Temple period that there could be a Judaism without the temple. And the idea that we can have a Judaism without the sacrifices and the temple service, they would say, well, what are you talking about? The Judaism is the sacrifices and the temple service. But I think that most Jews feel very comfortable today saying, you know, well, maybe it would have been, maybe it's unfortunate that we lost that and there was value to it, but what's really important in Judaism is, you know, is maybe the relationship with God or the Jewish wisdom contained in our texts or whatever they might emphasize. But I think that's important for us to understand how modern a phenomenon that is, or how much that is a way of looking at it that comes from our history. And so I think when we look at things today and we say, well, what defines Judaism? Is that the synagogue service, or is that the kosher laws, or is that the general idea of having a law, a religious law in general, that we might find, looking on the other end of it, that those actually weren't the really important things, and somehow the other things were emphasized. So I'm really optimistic if the question is, you know, will we and will future generations discover in this huge body of material stuff that really matters to them and find a way to build a culture around it, I think that we will. But I think that in order to accelerate that process, it's really important for us to understand that we should be supporting and we should be part of processes of innovation that are bolder and further out there than we might normally be.
A very cool, optimistic lesson that we will keep our eyes on in the future and to watch the innovation progress, and you're on the front lines of this. My guest today has been Daniel Liebenson. Dan, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks so much. It's really been great.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.